Okay, so I'll talk about a kind of experimental approach to reverse engineering of gene circuits in bacteria. So, engineering is when you want to build a machine that does something, right? You just design a machine that works and does something. Reverse engineering is when you're given a machine that does something and you want to understand how it works. What's its circuit diagram? What's its design? And in a way, you can think about biology, a lot of biology, as a reverse engineering problem, where you're giving this incredible technology a cell, and your goal is to understand what the circuit diagrams are. So, kind of a reverse engineering problem. And in this talk, I just want to talk about an approach to reverse engineering that's based on, first of all, very accurate measure of the internal degrees of freedom, promoter activities of a cell, temporally resolved measurements, and then using analysis algorithms to try to see if you can see the features of the circuits that underlie the cell responses. And the goal is try to develop the concept or what language we need to use when we talk about biology on the systems level rather than talking about interacting components. Try to talk about it in a kind of what computations large groups of interacting proteins do. So, as a model system, we choose E. coli, the sequence strain of E. coli, MG1655, which has about 4,400 genes. About half of the genes have a well-characterized function, and which is a lot compared to other organisms. Experiments in this, we chose it because it's for many reasons. One of the experiments in this organism are very, very easy since it divides so rapidly, and there's so many tools to manipulate this organism genetically. And it has a lot of well-characterized systems in it. It's also inherently appears to have a simple design of its gene regulation systems. And it's just a wonderful system to work with. All right, so let's start and see what's going on. So, the problem we're addressing is a problem of gene regulation. So, E. coli, let me go back for a second before we start with this biology. These cells live under very different conditions. They can live inside a mammal. 37 degrees with a lot of nutrients, et cetera, high density. Or they can live, let's say, in a pool of water, which is cold, almost no nutrients. They survive in these different environments. And the way they survive is by constantly adjusting their composition. They turn on systems of genes that are essential in the environment and turn off systems of genes that are non-essential. So they're always computing, in some sense, a response to different environmental cues. And they can sense, I mean, their space of inputs is large. They sense, the concentrations of dozens of sugars that they can eat, the 20 amino acids that they need, a few hundred chemicals, temperature, osmotic pressure, pH, all these factors go in for them to make a decision what systems they need of genes they need to activate and what systems of genes they need to shut down. So it's a molecular computer. And the basis of this computation in bacteria is typically the following. This is the DNA of the bacterium. The genes are arranged in operons, that is to say, a few genes can sit on one piece of RNA and be transcribed from the same promoter. So genes are turned into proteins. And the rate at which these genes are transcribed into RNA is controlled by a piece of DNA that lies upstream of the gene, and it's called the promoter region. And to this region, there's coded in the DNA are sites where RNA polymerase binds and where activator and repressor proteins can bind to modulate the rate at which these genes are turned into RNA and protein. And at this step is where most of the regulation in E. coli happens, as opposed to eukaryotes, where there's in this arrow, in this arrow, in this arrow, there's regulation everywhere. In E. coli, this also occurs, but predominantly at the level of the promoter. So the activity of this promoter, that is to say, how many times per second an RNA is made from this, based on what's coded in this piece of DNA, is a central variable. Okay, so.
Are there ribosomal binding affinities to the messenger RNA?
Sure. So the amount of the proteins that are created depend, let's say, on signals here, which determine how strongly it binds to the ribosomes. There is regulation at every stage. I mean, proteins can be degraded at a certain point in a regulated way, and this happens in some systems, and etc. But a lot of the regulation, most of the regulation in the systems known, occurs here. And you understand immediately that there could be networks built here, because these X's could be proteins that bind to promoters of other genes. Therefore, for instance, X could bind to its own promoter, making a negative feedback loop. Or X could bind to Z, and Z, the protein, could bind back to X. So you can make networks like this. In fact, that's what the cell does. So we have a situation where external signals can enter this, let's say, by causing a protein Y to change conformation, thereby bind to the promoter of gene Z. Z becomes activated. Z happens to be a transcription factor that, let's say, represses gene X and Y. Y goes down, and you reach a new steady state. So the goal is to map these kind of networks.
Is there evidence that cells with an ampli system reach other than steady state, strain detractors, bifurcation, various doubling?
I don't know about any evidence for strain detractors, but there is situations where you have limit cycles.
Are those part of the natural cell function, or are those mutations?
Well, cell cycle, for example, is a limit cycle. And you might imagine that it's actually designed not to go into all kinds of strange attractors, but it's not clear. Yeah. Yeah. This cell has a typical way the cell senses, a bacterium senses the outside world, is called a two-component system. It's just two proteins. One of them is a receptor that crosses the membrane, senses the outside world, and has a part in the inside world, inside of the cell. And the second is a diffusible protein that gets phosphorylated by this receptor according to the external conditions. Once it gets phosphorylated, it changes conformation, and it usually goes directly to the DNA to activate genes. These proteins, all the receptors are pretty homologous to each other, and all these response messengers are pretty homologous to each other. And so, looking at the E. coli genome, we know that there is approximately 20 receptors like this. Chemotaxis receptors, which we'll talk about in the afternoon, are among them. So there's at least 20 senses of smell, each one sensing usually multiple compounds. So I would say that there's order of magnitude of 100 stimuli in this level.
Oh yeah, okay.
So amino acids are sensed in a different way. Amino acids are sensed usually on the level that suppose you're running out of a certain amino acid, you're trying to synthesize a protein, the ribosomes get stuck, and there's a sensing there. So either you look at these receptors and you know that there's an order of 100 specific stimuli that are sensed by receptors, or you count how many essential metabolites there are. Right? So the cell, for instance, synthesizes amino acids, but if there's amino acids on the outside world, it shuts off all the synthesis pathways and turns on the utilization pathways. In fact, if there's an excess of amino acids, it turns them into nitrogen, which it needs to grow. It takes nitrogen from it. So that's what I mean by this balance. And so the order of magnitude, I would say there's hundreds of inputs, chemical inputs. Yeah, let's say. Oh, they also overlap a little bit. Like, for instance, temperature is. Yeah, I'll tell that. When I talk about chemotaxis, I'll talk about that. This part. Okay. So I would say the input space is hundreds of dimensions. Not only to this receptor, but to E. coli. So let's say, in this hundred, let's say, you know, hundreds of dimensional space, each point, there's a whole region where E. coli can grow, and each point, it's basically computing what promoter activities to have.
So when you think of this input as a digital input or?
No, continuous function. You know. Now this is really you can think about like the fascinating problem of trying to map the input to the internal states, with a small complication that there's memory. you remember, since proteins are expressed based on previous generations, you remember where you were in the past for a while. And you can also imagine that E. coli has the states where it can exist aren't... usually what happens is that there's discrete decisions. And I'll talk about a discrete decision like this. Like, to, for instance, to swim or not to swim. When, once you decide to swim, you make the whole flagella apparatus. Therefore, maybe this internal space is actually divided into attractors. And it will be interesting to map the basins of attraction of all these. Of course, this has never been done for any cell type, and this is just beginning. And, but this is a fascinating kind of almost a cognitive problem, right? You have a representation of the external world based on the activities of these promoters. It's like a reduction of the complete, maybe you don't care about exactly what the concentration of these hundreds of inputs are. What you care is we are in a pool of water. And therefore, you represent that inside as a symbol based on. Based, okay, so you understand. Twenty kinds of specific response regulators. They're to the first approximation, they're very specific. There is also evidence of this crosstalk. Okay, but let's get back to business here. So this is just a slide that's telling you what's on the blackboard here. Gene expression E. coli is primarily directed by the activity of promoters. The promoters are pieces of DNA that lie between promoter regions. They lie between the genes, and they're of order a few tens to a few hundred base pairs. They're small, unlike in eukaryotes where you can have something that's 100,000 base pairs away activating a gene. Here, this doesn't happen in E. coli. There's about 2,300 different promoters. Okay, so our experiment, the goal is to measure the activity of these promoters, that is to say, how many times per second an RNA is made based on the RNA polymerase and activators and repressors that bind to this piece of DNA. And to do this, we are able from the... we use a standard molecular biology method, which is to build a plasmid. Plasmid is like an artificial chromosome that can live inside the cell, which has on it a gene for a protein called green fluorescent protein. This is a gene that comes from a jellyfish. The aim of the exercise here is to get a temporally to get the activity of promoters in E. coli as a function of time under different conditions. And activity means the number of RNAs per second made from these promoters. Yes. And in order to accomplish this, we use a reporter strategy. What's a reporter strategy? We stick here a copy of this promoter region, a copy of this DNA. But instead of the gene that it's actually controlling on the chromosome, we stick in a different gene. This different gene is a green fluorescent protein. This is a protein that comes from jellyfish. About 5 years ago, it started a real revolution in cell biology because it allows you to visualize things in the cell. It's a protein that folds and becomes fluorescent green. Doesn't need anything else to do that. So what this thing does now is this promoter is sitting inside the cell, so the RNA polymerase and the repressors and activators bind to it. But instead of making the protein it usually makes, it makes fluorescent protein. So the fluorescence of the cell is proportional to how many times an RNA is made for the real protein that's sitting in the chromosome. We don't touch the chromosome. We don't touch the real protein. Everything is fine. We just add this extra unit. We have another copy of the promoter. And it's making always the same piece of RNA, the RNA of GFP with one ribosome binding site. So for all promoters, it's the same piece of RNA. And cells become fluorescent.
It's an identical promoter on the main chromosome making normal.
Yeah, exactly. So when we make these plasmids and put them into the E. coli cell, what we get is a cell that's a reporter cell for one promoter. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. When I say promoter in this talk, I mean a promoter region, which includes the binding site for RNA polymerase, activators, and repressors. In fact, what we do technically is we design PCR primers in order to get this piece that are actually about 100 base pairs into the gene here and into the gene here. And we grab this whole thing, stick it in to the plasmid, controlling to always the same plasmid controlling the GFP. Each different strain has a different promoter sitting in front of the GFP. So we end up with a collection of genetically engineered E. coli, which are all identical, except that they have this extra element. This element is always identical, except that it has a promoter region for gene number I. So strain number I is reporting for the promoter I. So this just explains it again. The gene X is intact on the chromosome. This thing reports for the promoter of gene X. And it's always a concern. The only thing we're perturbing is adding extra copies of the promoter, which you might think are interacting with the transcription factors and maybe diluting them a little bit. So it's always a concern whether this interferes with the cell or not. And I'll talk about the biological experiments we do to see whether it does or it doesn't. And the answer is that in the systems we look at, this it doesn't. This is the cell compensates for these extra copies, which are few. It's a low copy plasmid. It's 2 to 4 copies, about the same as the number of chromosomes. And I also say that we have a protocol where we can make these plasmids now 96 at a time. So we can, just doing all the regular steps of molecular biology, which I can get into in the end if anybody's interested, how you make these plasmids, we can make 96 of these at a time in a few weeks. So we've made about 200 for different well-characterized systems. Okay. So what do we do once we have these strains? What we do is we grow them. Here's a plate that has 96 little wells. And each well has a liquid with cells growing in it. Each well has a reporter strain for gene number I, I running from 1 to 96, right? Under the same conditions. And we put this into a machine, fluorimeter, that keeps a constant temperature, shakes them, and every, let's say, 5 minutes, goes in and measures fluorescence from each of these, and also measures light scattering, which is proportional to the number of cells there are in each of these. So you can get a measurement of fluorescence per cell at a resolution of, let's say, up to once per minute. In principle, you can get a continuous measurement if you build the right machine from this.
And you're going to show us evidence that the genes on the plasmid are read at the same rate that they're read in on the main.
Well, you know, how can you do that? I mean, if you measure RNA levels, for example, you always have a balance between production and degradation. So you can't really do that, but it's.
But then what you're reporting on is what's happening on the plasmid, not reporting what's happening on the
gene. I agree. Yeah, absolutely. And there could be differences. I mean, it could be that the chromosome is coiled differently than the plasmid. This is certainly something to think about. No. Actually, it's a great advantage for us that the GFP here is infinite lifetime. I'll explain why for a second. Okay, so the signal you get schematically, I'll show you signals in a second. This is just to explain what's going on. If this is intensity of fluorescence as a function of time, you get basically from an experiment like this up to 96 lines as a function of time at a 1 minute resolution. If you work really hard at getting all the biology steps right, you can get 5% reproducibility between day to day. And the right, we did it for a few genes, sticking them into the chromosome, and it looks very, very similar. But you can't say that for all genes. It's technically just harder to stick into the chromosome. So plasmids are simpler. And as you'll see, it's good enough, the plasmid system, for a lot of things.
They don't do anything. Will the cells do something for that plasmid? There's no reason for the cell to keep it around.
Oh, yeah, there is, because the plasmid also encodes an antibiotic resistance gene. And you put in antibiotics, so it can't lose it. And this is, again, a standard way to work with plasmids. That's why it doesn't kick it out.
Okay. Would it make sense to knock out a gene and put it in the plasmid instead?
To knock out a gene?
To knock out a gene in the main chromosome and put it in the plasmid, along with the reporter. Is that the only game in town to get that particular protein?
Well, you can do that. The thing is, then it'll make a larger perturbation to the DNA here, and we want to make a minimal perturbation. Besides, the technically knocking out every gene is very, very difficult. But
can you cross correlate this at selective time points with standard cDNA expression analysis where you do time portions, and that would get at David's earlier question about whether.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good experiment to do, and it's always a problem because when two labs do the same experiment, and you can try to reproduce exactly the same conditions. I mean, we get from this data that looks qualitatively the same. I mean, you know, genes get turned on when you expect them to. But the thing with DNA chips is the problem is they're measuring RNA levels. Now, in bacteria, RNA is very, very unstable. It has typically a 2-minute lifetime. And it changes between RNA and RNA. And this is a prime concern in controlling how much message there is. You see? And so it's different from measuring the rate of activation of promoter activity, of RNA. It's a different thing. So we don't expect it to be absolutely correlated. But this, of course, is closer. If you're interested in activators and repressors, this gives you a readout of the activators and repressors directly. Now, yeah, if you compare it to DNA chips, I mean, you look at a smaller number of genes, and so it's good for an analysis of particular systems. But experimentally, I worked with DNA chips when I was in Princeton with Arnie Levine on tumor, 72 tumors, and this, you can't compare the ease of, I mean, it's really, for instance, if you just, first of all, you know, we started the experiment from taking the cells from their freezer at minus 80 and stamping them into a plate of medium of interest and putting this into the machine and programming the machine to do what we want, and come back after, you know, 15 hours with a 300 time course, remarkably accurate experiment. And now we have an idea to do a next experiment. It just takes us one day, again, to do this and stick into the machine. So the time between a theoretical analysis or an idea to making an experiment is very short. The data is typically in chips, as we heard, you have a lot of errors, and that's basically because you have to take the cells, make juice out of them, hybridize them, you know, make juice out of them, convert RNA into cDNA, label it, hybridize it, read the chips, etc. And this is a big operation, especially if you want to do 300 time points, and you really need a company to do it or something. But here you just have 300 time points automatically, and the cells are living. You're not touching them. That's why I think you get such a high accuracy. You're just leaving them to be and fluoresce. And you don't have to lyse them, and all these steps add noise. And of course, it's much, much, much cheaper, needless to say. So it's fun. I mean, it's just a fun experiment to do. Okay, so now let's talk about.
Maya said this. What's the better reason
for it? Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's a very important point. GFP is indestructible. You take the bacteria in a bottle and you put them on the table, and after a week they all kind of decay, but the GFP is there. It's green. So the GFP is very, very stable. And this means that the signals always increase. And in fact, it's the signals measure the integral from 0 to t of the promoter activity dt, right? This is what the signals are measuring. But they're so smooth that you can differentiate the signal and get at this. How many new GFP are made per second per cell? It's the real signal. And it's that's why, if, for instance, if this GFP had a finite lifetime, this finite lifetime, like everything else in the cell, would be regulated. Then we'd have to worry about the balance between creation and degradation and figure out what that is for each condition. So, but the fact that it has an infinite lifetime is an advantage. It's also, okay, so.
Aren't you worried that the GFP build up is making
cells? Yeah, we're worried about that. So this GFP that we use is a one made by Falkov and Cormack, and it's optimized for folding in E. coli. And that's why it folds very fast, minutes. And also, it's very non-toxic. I mean, when you have a lot of GFP in the cell, it grows a little bit slower. But for the ranges we're usually worried about, doesn't affect the growth. And a large fraction of the cell's protein can be GFP, and the cell still lives. So that's why it's. Of course, all these are very good concerns that have to be controlled for every system we look at. And always remember this. Okay, so now let's turn to. Okay, so we have this system, and now we want to try to demonstrate whether we could use this experiment in order to solve an inverse problem. The inverse problem is given this accurate expression data, can we look at a circuit and figure out the structure of a gene circuit? And to do this, we chose one of the best characterized gene circuits in biology, which I'll tell you about now. It's the flagella biosynthesis module of E. coli, because 30 years of genetics gave us the circuit in remarkable detail. And it's a good place to start to see if we can compare genetics to the circuit and see what we can learn. So, okay, so this is E. coli. It's a 1 micron long organism. And under certain conditions, it decides to swim. And it turns on these incredible molecular motors. And attached to flagella, which are longer than the cell, as you notice, which have a helical pitch. There's, let's say, 6 to 10 of these per cell. And the motors rotate at 100 hertz. The flagella cause the cell to zoom, like 30 microns per second, huge, through the water, which is very viscous at these scales. Why does it need to swim? It needs to swim, as the saying goes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. It's a stress response. When the cells are dividing very rapidly, there's lots of food around, they turn off the gene system for making flagella. Okay? So the cells aren't making these. And the old flagella get diluted out by cell division. These divide between the two daughter cells, et cetera, et cetera, until most of the population has none. Also, when the bacteria have depleted their food and it's very stressful, they go into what's called stationary phase, where they turn on a whole set of genes that's protective. And under these conditions, they don't make new flagella either. They make them when they're growing well, but they sense they're going to run out of food. So, this is number of cells. It's a function of time. In a typical experiment where you take a bottle of food and you put a cell into it, a small number of cells into it, this has an exponential phase where cells are dividing every cell cycle. And then, like everything else in life, it saturates when they run out of food, right? So the place where they turn on the system is around here. Motility phase. Again, one of those regulated decisions the cells make, and it's quite complicated, not fully understood exactly under what's the attractor of this behavior. But it's definitely easy to get them to do it under experimental conditions. Okay. This phenomenon is so fascinating. It attracted a lot of beautiful studies. Among them, structural studies where people can get a picture. This is the motor, just the motor in the membrane. E. coli has two membranes, an inner membrane and an outer membrane. And this is just the motor, order of a few tens nanometers. The motor is composed out of 50 different proteins that form rods and shafts and brushings and stators and rotors and self-assemble into this machine. Right? It works on a proton gradient. Protons go inside and somehow convert that into angular momentum. 1,000 protons per revolution go in. Okay. And it self-assembles. The entire thing is made out of proteins. There's 50 different kinds of proteins.
And it does it in the process of bioassembly.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, it's a little bit like, like this always people say, like, you take a bag of Legos and you throw them on the floor and it makes a house. This is the kind of problem that you have here. Amazing assembly process of a functioning motor. It's remarkable. Okay.
What is the time scale for the assembly?
So this is something actually we measured in our experiments. It takes, under our conditions, 3 generations to make a motor, which is to say, when they're starting up, they're making the first components for their grandchildren.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But under other conditions, it could be faster. It all depends on hard you kick the system. But it takes at least a cell generation.
So it could actually be moving around one third. No, then it cannot.
Well, yeah, it can make. I mean, it, sure. Yeah. Oh. You have when in a typical cell at steady state, if you can, there's completed motors, half completed motors.
Okay.
Yeah.
Time 20 minutes.
20 minutes is like the world record of 100-meter dash. The you can get them like in the lab, good conditions, 25-30 minutes, and our conditions. We use the minimal, well, chemically defined medium, salt and sugar. That's about 100 minutes. And they sometimes grow, they can grow. They have conditions where it's 4 hours, 16. I mean, this is all, again, scales with, for instance, temperature. There is the e^-1/t scaling of growth rate over a range. The whole kind of interesting thing. OK, so now let's take a look at the gene circuit. That is to say, these 50 genes are organized into 14 operons. So some operons have 7, 8, 9 genes together.
Yeah. The rate of production of these motors scales with the division time.
Yeah, roughly. And with how stressful it is. So you kick you can. Some stress conditions they make more.
Now you said
faster.
That's 3 generations to produce a
motor. Oh yeah. So that scales with the generation time. Yes, that's right. Right. Yeah. It scales with the generation time.
Or no. Be built from scratch?
No, they're built from scratch. So you can take conditions, in effect, in part of our experiments, where there's no pre-existing motors, and they're built from scratch. Okay, so let's take a look now at the gene circuit. So finally, we're talking about a gene circuit. It's not a, okay, it's a circuit. I don't show the circuit part, but it's a gene cascade where these 50 proteins are arranged. So 50 proteins are made by 50 genes. These 50 genes are arranged into groups, 14 groups, which are 14 operons. So some operons have 6 or 7 genes in them. And these operons have been arranged by genetics, by classical and very successful method of molecular biology of using mutants into 3 classes. This is the way it works. The first class is just one operon that makes a transcription factor. These 2 genes together make a transcription factor that activates class 2 genes. Class 2 genes self-assemble into the motor, which crosses the membrane, and a flexible hook thing that is attached to the motor. One of these guys, Fly A, is a protein that's a transcription factor that activates class 3 genes. It binds to the DNA upstream of all these genes and activates them. And these are 6 different operons here that together make the flagellum, and the chemotaxis system, which is a signaling system that tells the cell where to go, directs the cell's motions. And this little part here, these 2 operons, Mecha and Mocha, these little part here will be the subject of the talk in the afternoon, how this computer works and tells the cell where to go. But this is just one part of this whole 14 gene. Okay. Now, how do we know this? And this has been 30 years of brilliant work by in many labs in the US and in Japan and in other places to figure this out. So first of all, how do we know all the genes in a system? So since it's all done by deleting components, right? Genetics is making mutations and deleting components. So since swimming is a nice thing to look at, you can see if the bacteria swim or not, then it's what you do is you mutate randomly. You take a population of bacteria, each one of which has a mutation somewhere in the chromosome, and you look for ones which don't swim. And then you figure out where this mutation sits. And this way, you can narrow it down to all the genes where, when deleting them, the bacteria don't swim anymore. Okay, and second, how do you place the genes in a, and you find these 14 operons, how do you place these in a temporal order like this, in a cascade? And this is a beautiful logic. You delete this gene, and nothing gets turned on. So you know it's at the top. You delete this gene here, this gets turned on, but these don't get turned on. Whereas if you delete a gene here, this gets turned on, and these get turned on, and these get turned on, except for the gene you deleted. So you can order by this. And in fact, there was one paper where people did all possible 14 by 13 divided by 2 combinations of deleting and noticing whether a gene is activated and got this picture. It's really a lot of work. Very, very beautiful logic. Okay. So this is genetics. This is the art of genetics. Of course, this is the way we know almost everything we know in biology comes from genetics and biochemistry, like this, using drugs or using all the pathways that Barbara Wall showed yesterday, for example, you know, because of deleting components. This, of course, has great and fundamental disadvantages. I mean, it works beautifully. It's very important. But there are places where you know it doesn't work. For example, and this is something that happens in higher organisms a lot. Sometimes you have a gene that you think is very, very important. And you spend 2 years and you make a mouse that's missing this gene. And the mouse is perfectly healthy. It has no... You can hardly see any effect. And the reason is a lot of times because this gene X, there's another gene Y that has a little bit overlapping function. It can do 10% of what gene X is doing. But when gene X is gone, the cell is shifted to a new state where Y is increased because it senses that X function is gone. And therefore, it compensates for X. And therefore, you're blind. You don't know what X does. You understand? So by deleting components, you're shifting the cell. You're changing the equations. You're shifting the cell to a different physiological state, and you're studying it there. And this is so. What we'll try to do here is to map a circuit on an intact system, right? Just by measuring under natural conditions what's going on. So it's an important point. Okay. So what we did, we built these reporter strains for each of these 14 operons. So we have 14 bacteria. Each one reports with GFP fluorescence for the activity of these 14 different promoter regions of these 14 different genes. And now we ask very, very, very simple questions. The first question is, by measuring the kinetics of these 14 strains under a few different conditions, can we first of all divide these 14 genes into three groups? That's simple. And the second question is, can we order these groups in a temporal order? Very simple, right?
Right now, you're just checking the results of these traditional experiments.
Yeah, that's why we use this. In fact, actually, what I would say, we use this as a benchmark to calibrate our method to see if. Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry. Each of these screen groups of letters stands for. So this operon has two genes. It's called FLHD and FLHC. And this operon has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 genes. Fly L, fly M, fly N, fly O. And I can explain to you what the normal nomenclature comes from, but it's not so interesting. FL means when you delete this gene, there's no flagella.
So in 30 years of experiment, people also found by knocking out genes and putting in genes, they find better swimmers, with people that swim much faster and so on?
Yeah, for instance, in a certain condition, if you make more of this, you make more flagella and you swim faster. So the cell is... Yeah, the cell is tuning that too.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So here's what the data looks like, and I'll show it to you in two different ways. Here we see, this is time. These are two conditions. This is time, 10 minutes, 10 hours. And each row here represents a different promoter, 14 different promoters. And the activity, or the amount of GFP produced by these promoters goes from blue to red. Blue is low and red is high. So in this system, this gene here gets turned on at this time point and then kind of flattens out. Total GFP flattens out. If you take the derivative, promoter is shut out. Okay.
Logarithmic scale?
Yeah, SEC. Log scale of color. Okay, so... in order to address these simple questions, can we divide these genes into groups? And can we find a timing order between the groups? We use algorithms. One is data clustering, which is you've heard a lot about, which is a standard way for dividing data like this into groups. The second is a kind of extension of clustering algorithms to take into account the timing. So... what we used is the simplest single linkage clustering algorithm, and the results I'll show don't depend on clustering algorithms for the few that we tried, to make a phylogenetic tree, like a binary tree of genes, where genes are close together when they have a similar temporal evolution over the experiments. So we take the data looks like, let's say, 100 time points under condition A, 100 time points under condition B, 100 time points under condition C. Those are the vectors. Okay. The metric we used is just correlation distance. So we took the log data, we normalized it to 0 and standard deviation 1, and we used Euclidean distance. And this is equivalent to 1 minus the correlate, twice the correlation.
Twice. Right.
So we measure, let's say, every 5 minutes. So it's a 100-minute time course. And we glue the one-time course to the next time course. So I'm going to say very simple, and could be, I'm sure you could do many much more sophisticated analysis.
So what's represented on the top board is
one gene.
One gene.
Right. And here is its brother, a second promoter. In a
300-dimensional space.
Yeah, there's 14 lines, each one with, you can have hundreds, you know, we generated thousands of time points for this data. But you see, so it's actually, right. And there's other ways to do it, is, for instance, to extract kinetic parameters from each of these and to cluster those, and it all comes out to the same, because qualitatively in the data, I'll show you, there's something very strong that divides the genes into groups. The next thing we did, okay, so once you get a phylogenetic tree, you know, phylogenetic trees usually made by these clustering algorithms, there's an arbitrariness whether this comes here or here, right? Or this comes here or here. This is all arbitrary. So we just wanted to get an order sense. So what we did was a kind of a hierarchical algorithm for ordering a tree. And the way we do it is you look at the first division, and you take the centroid of the two subtrees. So this is the centroid of one, and this is the centroid of the other. And then you make a measure for which one is earlier. For example, I shifted the correlation, seeing whether it's a positive or negative time shift. It will put them one on top of the other. There's better ways to do it. You figure out which of these centroids is earlier, and you put that one on the right. Now you go to the next subtree. You do it. For these two centroids, figure out which one is earlier. And then you organize the whole tree, starting from the big clusterings down to the small clusterings, and end up with an order that has some information about the timing.
It's not exact, because the subtree is an outlier.
Right.
Earlier than
right. But it is, since you're starting from the top trees, and you're actually using centroids, and you're averaging over, it is kind of robust to the main timing. But of course, again, I say this is a very simple-minded thing and could probably be made more precise and rigorous. And when you do that, and now you arrange these genes according to this clustering and temporal labeling, you get, you see the following things. First of all, you see that the first split that occurs is very clear. Oh, this is statistical significance compared to taking the data and randomizing, permuting this axis, doing it, let's say, 1,000 times, and asking how many times you get a bigger depth of separation. It's a p-value. So these are very significant. Once in 1,000 or something you get. So the first separation separates this guy from the rest. This is the master regulator. And it goes up way before any of the other genes. It looks completely different and separates. And the second split separates these genes from these genes, which contain class 2 genes and 3 of the class 3 genes, and the other 3 of the class 3 genes. And these class 3 genes are really kinetically stuck to the class 2 genes. And then a further, less significant, still significant, but less significant cluster is just separates these class 2 genes. And I should say that you need at least two different conditions in order to do this, because this is, or two conditions or more, because this is based on relative motions of groups of these genes. They move together under different conditions. Right, so for instance, if this was your measure for early NS, it would. But from this algorithm, you compare this to the centroid of this whole cluster. Centroid of this whole cluster is later. You see? But anyway, the measure that we use is actually sensitive to the early parts, not to this, let's say, half point of a Michaelis minimum. Exactly, yeah. I think you should in this case, if you're interested in rise times. We can talk about that. Oh, I should say also, this data is normal. In order to look at rise times, it's very important to normalize the data so that the maximum is 1. Because otherwise, a gene that gets turned on much more than another gene looks like it goes on earlier. So you have to normalize everything so the maximum is 1, right? So this is what happened. And the maximum is after this 10 hours. It's
The hierarchy was determined with 2 conditions?
Yeah, the 2 conditions here, but you can take basically any 2 conditions of the conditions we have, and it's the same structure. I mean, the same structure for these significant. With 1 condition, it looks different. It's kind of, you don't get significant, you know, here is a whole continuum of timing, so. But if you use 2 conditions or more, you have this advantage, these groups move together, and then you separate them.
Yeah. This phylogenetic corresponds to 3 stages in assembling the
motor. Oh, right, okay, so yeah, so what you get here is you get 2-3 cluster and a 3 cluster. It's almost exactly like the genetics. Yeah, this class 1, these are class 2 genes, and these are class 3 genes. It's almost the same as in genetics. And if you look at this extra cluster, you actually get... Uh-huh. And the timing is 1, 2, 3. It's fine. Just like a...
So this is genetic. Different? I'm confused. Is this different from a... if you want to make an evolutionary tree, this would be different.
Yeah, well, it's the same algorithm, except that instead of expression, you put in a sequence of the 16S... ribosomal RNA, whatever you want, and you get a tree. Uh-huh. But here you have a time courses, so we have timing, and this timing can be used to also arrange the tree. And
so to a naive physicist, this would mean that early in its evolution history, that people like can only make...
Oh, no. This doesn't have anything to do... I mean, it's the same algorithm. If you put in data that's relevant to evolution, then you get the same tree. But is this the same algorithm? But here we use a different data, so it tells us nothing about evolution, as far as I know. Okay, but let's now... Okay, so that was nice to get this, to get to basically, oh yeah.
If you just make, you have a chart, you have a way to determine the turn on time.
Right.
If you just label them by turn on time and order them as it is.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting at. No. Okay. So then, this was nice to recover what was known before. But then we got a shock because we found something that we didn't expect that was new and was the following. When we here's the same data for 1 condition plotted. This is log fluorescence sensitivity versus time, and you have the different genes get turned on. What we expect, or in my mind in the beginning, I wanted to see class 2 genes in one bundle and class 3 genes in another bundle because they're turned on by 1 transcription factor, and just to see, you know, a nice class 2, class 3. It's very clear. But instead, we got the spread. And the spread was kind of annoying, and we repeated the experiment again and again and again and again, and 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, we always got the same spread. And then we took a look at which genes are which. And it turns out there's always a first, within the class 2, the red ones here, there's always a first gene, and a second gene, and a third gene, and a fourth or promoter, and a fifth promoter, and sixth. And so within the class 3, there's always a first, second, third, fourth. And this order repeats itself from experiment to experiment to experiment. And we took, and of course, this wasn't known that there's any order inside these groups, because nobody ever looked at this timing. And we took a look at which gene it is that goes up first, and which gene it is that goes up second. And then we got, well, I got this goosebumps, because... Yeah. Yeah. Or one of the conditions. One of the conditions. Oh, the one isn't shown. Yeah, it looks like this. Looks like this. Starts up.
It starts early,
and then.
And they're all normalized to 1 at long times.
Yeah, they're normalized to 1 at long times. That's right.
And somehow FLHD is special.
It has a higher Hill coefficient.
Oh.
Looks like. It looks steeper. So. Okay, so let me just tell you. What we got is an order, and the order corresponded to the spatial position of the proteins along spatial position along the flagellum. So the temporal order corresponded to where the proteins are in the assembling flagellum. And it goes like this. The first protein that's made is the master regulator. The second protein that's made inside class 2 makes a ring that's just touching the inner membrane of the cells. The next guys make a ring that's sitting in the inner membrane of the cell. The third set makes the rods and the rings and this hook that go outside of the cell. And the last person in class, last promoter in class 2 is the transcription factor that activates class 3. Now, inside class 3, the first thing that gets turned on is a little adapter protein that sits on the end of this hook. And the second thing that gets turned on is the protein that makes up the flagella, subunit of this. And the last thing that gets turned on is the computer, the chemotaxis system that tells the cell where to go. So there's a detailed order we could see, because in this order is like 15-minute resolution, 10-15-minute resolution activation. So you can only see it if you have very accurate expression data. So what do we make of this? First of all, First of all, it's apparently this order isn't essential for making flagella, because genetic experiments show us that when you, for instance, take this gene here and delete it, there's no flagella. But when you put it back under a foreign promoter, a constant promoter, IPTG, lac promoter, flagella are made again. So timing is probably not essential for making flagella. But you can imagine that timing can make things more efficient. That is to say, you're not making this gene before you have this gene. So it makes it, for maybe it's more efficient, you don't want to. Okay, that's the first point. The second point is, when we started this experiment, we were looking at promoter activity, which doesn't include things like RNA stability, protein synthesis, protein-protein interactions, etc. So we didn't expect to see any kind of information about assembly of the flagella, because assembly of the flagella happens after the proteins are made, and they regulate each other, and they... But it turns out that it looks like evolution here has been so efficient in pushing everything to the right order that you can even see these steps in the order of promoter activity. So you can get information you didn't expect about late stages by looking at this first stage of activation. Okay.
You can swap class 2 genes to class 1 promoters to screw up?
Yeah, actually we're trying to do that now, to reprogram this temporal program. Mm-hmm.
So if I understand correctly, you said this is the most sensible order, right? From the plot, wouldn't want to...
Yes, I think so, yeah.
The
before they're needed, yeah.
They're
assembled, right. Yeah.
It's not essential. In principle, you could reverse
Yes. That's observation. That's based on this genetic work.
It would be somewhat more inefficient because the ones that were waiting around might degrade.
They might degrade. They might, for instance, it's known that if you make a lot of this and it doesn't have a way to get out, mm-hmm. the cells really become very sick, because this is tens of thousands of subunits. Really, cell becomes so it's important to. Okay.
So, yeah. Why does it appear that sharp distinction between class 2 and class 3 when class 4 genetic cells?
Okay, because first of all, you do see it when you. I mean, this is definitely a different cluster, but it's a. I agree with you. It's not as sharp as in genetics. Why? Because genetics, what you do is you knock out a component, and you see that this component controls these genes. And then you knock out a component, you see this component knocks out this gene, it's designed to that. Here we're looking at kinetics. And it turns out that the system is designed so that these guys' expression is stuck to these guys' expression. So it's a different separation. It has a different logic. Maybe you like it more because it actually tells you functionally that it's waiting, it's pausing while the flagellum grows before it turns on the chemotaxis system. So it's a complementary approach, I would say. And then we're trying to figure out strategies to actually find, out of a group like this, which groups are co-regulated. And I can talk about that. Based on kinetics, I can talk about that. Okay. So just to summarize this, what we did here was a few weeks of, I mean, once we got all the plasmids and we got all the conditions right and stuff, basically the measurements needed to get this is a few weeks of just measuring different conditions, under natural conditions without perturbing the flagella system. And what we get out of this with very simple algorithms is basically the main structure of the circuit that was determined by genetics. And separation into classes and a temporal ordering. And then we can see things that you can't see just by looking at genetics, which is this detailed temporal order within a group that's all regulated by one transcription factor that maps somehow to assembly steps of this, many assembly steps of this multi-protein complex.
I'm just curious, is there such motors in higher organisms like humans?
Yeah, there's an analogy, there's homologies to these guys. For instance, say ATP synthase. There's a very common protein that makes ATP inside all our cells.
ATP, the energy generator.
Yeah, and it's actually, it turns out to rotate like this.
It's the same mechanism?
It's homologous to some of these proteins.
What does homologous mean?
Homologous means that when you look at its sequence, you can see that its sequence is very similar to the sequence of some of these proteins. And then there's motors in many places, and of course, at least about half of the species of bacteria have flagellar motors, and they're all very homologous, and it looks like the network is also very homologous. And
in plants too, it's
I guess so, yeah.
This implies that one learns from this, like,
one activates all six.
Yeah.
Or
right.
Nevertheless, there is a temporal order.
Right. Oh, okay. So, what's the mechanism, you ask? Okay. So, I'll add the mechanism, even though I have to say that, in my opinion, the mechanism is less. For me, it's less important what the mechanism is, rather than this reverse engineering system where you can stick in. Okay. I'll just say what the mechanism is. So, we went on to look at the DNA regions, these promoter regions, that sit in front of each of these genes. And all these class 2 genes have a consensus binding site in front of them, which is the FLHDC, this guy's binding site. There's a sequence where this binds and activates the gene. So you take all of these and you form a consensus sequence, 13 base pair consensus sequence. But each one of them doesn't have exactly the consensus sequence, it has mutations in the consensus sequence, as is always the case. And when we rank them according to which one has the fewest, is closest to the consensus sequence, the first ones have closest to the consensus sequence, and the middle ones are farther from the consensus sequence, and the last two are farthest from the consensus sequence. Yeah, so I mean, the simplest hypothesis, and I'm not saying this is proves anything, but just saying the simplest hypothesis is that these six or these seven promoters are graded in binding affinity to this transcription factor. And as you turn on the system, the transcription factor concentration as a function of time goes up, 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 up. And here it crosses the threshold for activating gene number 1 because it has the highest binding affinity for its promoter, right? So this is T1. And here it crosses the binding affinity for the next gene. This is T2. Okay? And finally, it crosses the affinity for T7, so it's the last one. The same thing happens when we look at the DNA regions of these genes. The first one has the highest similarity to its, these six guys have their own consensus sequence to fly A. This one has the highest, and this one has the lowest. Now, it's when you look at consensus sequences, it's limited. You don't really know the binding affinities because it depends also on sequence context and position, etc. But at least it suggests, consistent with the simple hypothesis, that again, this transcription factor fly A goes up, 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 and then it activates the first, the highest affinity, next highest affinity, next highest. Okay? So this is the simplest, and we're trying to test this now by taking these promoters, just like you suggested, and mutating them, taking this promoter and making mutations so it looks more like this promoter and trying to see whether you can reprogram the temporal program. See whether that... And of course, there's other ways to test this hypothesis. But okay, so here in our experiments, we always have the same ribosomal binding site as that of GFP. So this isn't a factor in our experiments. But in the flagella system, each gene has its own ribosome binding site and presumably its concentration is controlled with respect to how many is needed. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's a negative feedback. In this system, let me get to that in the end. In this system, there's much more interesting control going on about this cascade. And it's for us an open problem how to find that from the kinetics. So I'll get to that in the end. There's a negative feedback here. Yeah. The strongest ones tend to be closer to the... I don't know... Yeah, it's over? Yeah? Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. No, it's fine. It's fine. Yeah.
Right.
There is. So. Okay. So this system can also be used to look at promoter activity at the single cell level. And here's a microscope picture of bacteria. And the bacteria are about 1 micron big, right? So this is a field of view you can grab. You can look in a field of view at hundreds of bacteria, if you wish. And a fluorescence microscope can just give you a very accurate reading of the fluorescence. And it's pretty simple image analysis allows you to figure out where cells are and where it's background, and just figure out fluorescence per unit area. And get distributions of gene expression. As you see, they're pretty broad. And typically you get, you know, threefold easily between cell to cell, threefold differences in gene expression. So really a serious thing to remember when you're looking at gene networks is the components are uncertain. The rate at which proteins are synthesized, you know, the rate at which RNAs are made, and the process by which they're turned into proteins are all stochastic processes. And there's a discrete amount of discrete reactions. And we're talking about sometimes, if you want to make 100 proteins, you make 10 RNAs. Each one of them turns on average into 100 proteins. So you have a Poisson process making RNA. And a Poisson process, how many proteins per RNA are made? So you're getting into serious stochastics, low numbers, and oh yeah, and then there's tons of GFP. There's tons of GFP in the cell. Right, but still, I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying that I explained the numbers. I'm just saying the experimental fact is a broad distribution of GFP from cell to cell. Of course, this is... No, okay, the GFP here has been, you know, it's always being made. It's always being diluted as the cells divide. So this is after a process of growth in a certain condition. And then you take a snapshot. That the integration, that you're not asking about the integration time of the camera, I assume.
No, I'm asking.
Yeah, so this is the outcome of a long process of cell division and activation. Of course, you can do experiments where under the microscope you turn on a promoter. Take a look what's going on. Then you see each cell turning on at a different time, to a different level. And like, I don't want to say anything quantitative, but I'm just saying that it's a jungle of stochastic.
After tens of minutes of making GFP, you're still seeing differences.
Yeah. No, there's a mutation rate of 10^-9 per base pair. That is to say, since the genome is about 10^6, after 1,000 generations, there'll be one mutation in the genome. So we take these bacteria all frozen and only grow them for a few generations, 10, 20 generations. So this population is mostly isogenic, has the same DNA. This is non-genetic variability or fluctuations. I'm sure you'll hear more about that in the coming weeks, but okay.
Is it possible that there can be small fluctuations that get amplified and maybe you've been talking about
that? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, there are, because for instance, typically a few RNAs are made and each RNA is turned into a lot of proteins, and yeah. Okay. Especially when you consider what I just told you about the flagella system, where we measured an average over 10^6, 10^7 cells. These lines show you a temporal separation of 10, 15 minutes. It's very interesting to us, and we don't know the answer, what's happening on the single cell level. Is the timing on the single cell level of these processes as accurate as on the average? Is it more accurate than on the average? Is it less accurate than on the average? I'll just make the point that this simple proposed hypothetical mechanism for how you can turn things on by having a transcription factor concentration go up and then cross the versus thresholds might survive a stochastic situation where this line is now an integral over a random walk. It'll still cross these thresholds at least in order if it's a monotonous function. Right? All right, whatever. It's a noisy signal that increases. We'll still cross. We'll still cross things in order, but the timings will be different, right? So that's maybe one simple expectation you might have for what's happening in the single cell level. But So we're designing experiments to look at that with using this system, since we're able to see single cell level. In fact, under the microscope, it's possible to also see at the same time whether flagella are being made or not. You can get the biological output together with the gene. Excuse me? Yes. Concentrations. Concentrations are very hard to measure, so I don't know the answer, but I just say that typical transcription factors like LAC repressor are on the order of tens per cell. And in this system, FLHDC looks like a regular transcription factor, more or less. The second transcription factor is an alternate sigma factor that binds RNA polymerase, and this is order of hundreds per cell sometimes. So that's the order of magnitude, I guess.
What's the variation in intensity, which is just due to the fact that your microscope has a certain focal depth at which it looks?
Yeah, so that's a good, so when you do an experiment like this, you calibrate very carefully using beads that are the same size as the bacteria and have a known amount of fluorescent material on them. And in fact, they come, you can get beads that cover logarithmically a scale of intensities, and you can get in one frame bacteria and also a calibration curve. And then estimate this. And it's very, very good. I mean, you can get the variations due to experimental looking at beads are much, much narrower than what you get there. And which, you know, what you get experimentally from cell to cell is huge. In an experiment like this, if it was experimental errors like this, it's easy to see. There's another way to measure this, a second way to measure this, and this is using what's called a fluorescence-activated cell sorter. It's a machine that's in every biology department. It's a machine that takes cells, separates them into a droplet, shines a laser at them, measures their fluorescence, and then you get a cell-by-cell division of fluorescence, and it can also put it into this test tube or that test tube according to its fluorescence intensity. And there you can also get, in just in a minute, you get, you know, thousands of cells. You get very good distributions of gene expression, you understand, over the population. So it's another way to measure. So, yeah, this also works very well with these bacteria. Okay, so I'm going to summarize the talk and then go into some discussion until you feel that you want to go away and it's okay. I won't be offended if you just leave. And so the questions we want to address now, or we're addressing now. Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay. So our goal is to try to build experiments and algorithms that allow you to take data like this and print out maps of possible circuits. Okay, and one thing that I'll talk about soon, but that, for instance, we'd like to have our experimental ways to detect feedback loops. Okay, that's another motif that occurs a lot. Cascades, we believe maybe we can see cascades. Divide genes into modules based on correlated expression. Divide modules into submodules. Look at the temporal order. Now we want to see if we can see feedback loops. And basically, try to come up with a division of E. coli into a kind of circuit map like this. Okay. It would be very nice, for example, to try to think about an experiment where you know, from DNA chips or something like this, you come up with 20 genes of unknown function that go up and down together, and you think they're a system, and use this method to try to come up with a circuit diagram before knowing even what the function is, and then maybe verifying it by knocking out what looks like a transcription factor, seeing if it's... So that would be nice if we can do that. This problem of single cells is a very interesting theoretical problem because you have networks that are designed from unreliable components, and yet every cell makes flagella. I mean, in the end, you have the finished product, I can guarantee you. How does it work? We'll talk about that also in the afternoon about how the chemotaxis system works. What I talked about in the beginning, this cognitive problem of how E. coli represents the external world. How much is it true that this dynamical system has discrete fixed points that represent chunked situations about the external world that are pre-programmed to go into, and how many spurious minima there are, and how can you map the boundaries of the attractors? All these problems are open. What do these attractors look like in biology? You know, so this is very interesting. From a statistical mechanics point of view, what I find very interesting is, can we find motifs on the level of circuits? So when we now look at a lot of circuits, in my lab we teach ourselves a lot about E. coli, very superficially, but when you look at different circuits, you start to see there's a style. This is not designed by a human being, this is designed by evolution. Evolution has designed a circuit, but the circuit has a style. I can talk a little bit about what this style is. One striking thing about this style is how modular it is, rather than neural network-like, and other things that recur. So you can ask, in statistical mechanics, what if in the manifold of all possible networks, the biological networks sit on some kind of manifold? It's stylized. The style is like what defines this manifold? And why are biological circuits designed like this and not alternate designs that do the same thing? What's the constraints that make it sit on a manifold? And I think this noise, resistance to noise like this, we have one constraint that's very important. Some designs won't be resistant to noise. They get thrown away. Okay? It's a natural occurring process. Also, the observation that the design of these networks has striking similarities to what human engineers design, like modularity and other things, make you wonder whether there's underlying similarity between design circuits, whether it's by evolution or by human beings. And this kind of understanding the laws of nature that apply to design systems is, in my opinion, the most fascinating part of this. But of course, we'll know more once we see what a map of a large part of an organism looks like. So in our lab, we now designed, like I said, about 200 of these for different well-characterized systems, and some of them we have data that's similar to the flagellar system. We can see very interesting behavior and different kind of decision-making processes and things like this. So it's a lot of fun, and it's a tremendous amount of experiments to do and questions. And we're at the Weizmann, and we're sitting in the physics of complex systems and biology, molecular cell biology, but the lab is inside the biology department. And the people have come from physics and biology backgrounds, and Shiraz and Levital did the experiments, most of the experiments that I showed about the flagellar system, in collaboration with Mike Surrett from Canada. And okay, that's it for the talk. And of course, Stan Leibler, very inspiring for this work too.
All this, I guess, this toy system works very well with the technique you have, because there's no really network, it's just a linear thing, right? That's what turned on that one.
Yeah.
Once you have feedback sensing, what kind of can you actually get anything from this kind of analysis?
So of course this system has feedbacks.
It doesn't?
It does, yeah. I didn't show them in this graph.
Okay,
but
is it from the data? Can you
yeah, that's the question. So obviously, I'll show you the system has, I'll describe a little bit the feedbacks in the system, but they don't stop you from seeing the structure in this system and other systems that we know about too. But the question is how to get at finding that there are feedbacks now. So here is our system, XY, X1 activates Y1 to Y7, and Y7 activates Z1 to Z6. You understand this? This is just our system, okay? We don't need to worry about gene names because it's not interesting. So there's two feedbacks here, at least. Here's feedbacks, what you were asking. This is the simple thing I showed, but in reality it's more complicated. First of all, Y7 has a positive feedback on itself and also on all these other guys. So it's a transcriptional activator also of itself. The second... Yeah? No, it's known. I don't know how to deduce it from my data. I'm saying this is an open problem. Second thing that happens is a feedback. This occurs at the transcriptional level. This is a transcriptional activator of itself, as well as X. It's also transcriptional. Okay. There's another feedback that doesn't occur on the transcriptional level. But it's an amazing thing I'll tell you about now, because I find it incredibly beautiful the way this feedback is designed. And this feedback, the purpose is, once the flagella are made and ready, shut the system off. It's very reasonable, right? Okay. X gets signals from the external world. External world means transcription factors that are sensitive to the external world. One of them is the osmotic shock sensor. No, you need to make more flagella and more flagella and more flagella. I mean, the cells keep dividing, you want to make more flagella and more flagella. The external world tells you where to shut X off. Okay? So.
What David is asking is, if you don't need flagella, X is on.
Yeah. Oh, if you don't need flagella, you see, the cell decides.
You don't want to produce any more flagella.
The cell decides. Okay. This decision whether to produce more flagella or less flagella doesn't depend on are there a flagella right now. It just depends on signals from the external world, apparently.
C6 shut off Y7.
Yeah.
That means that X will produce already Y1 to Y7.
No, yeah, but it doesn't shut it off completely. I don't know what to tell you. If X is on, there'll be still production of new flagella. But if X is off, I suppose I don't know. Maybe it's just tuning it. I don't know the answer.
But it's real consumption is the same effect where you make a lot of
proteins. Excuse me.
Where you use all the make a lot of proteins. The production of new proteins come in the last row.
Oh yeah. This Z3 here, FlyC. This is the killer. This is the subunit of the flagella. The flagella is a hollow pipe made out of 11. Flyces per circumference, and flyces go through the flagella and assemble at the end. And, order of 10 to the 5th flyces are made to make this flagella, which is of order of a few percent, 1-2% of the cell protein. It's a huge, huge expenditure. You want to keep it? Yeah. It's not Z6. I would say this is a functional feedback. Oh, let me tell you about the feedback.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't occur in transcription. It occurs on the protein-protein level. I'll tell you. No repressors and activators occurs on the protein-protein level. This is a transcriptional feedback.
No.
Well, the way we know this is by genetics. So if you knock out Y7, when you knock out Y7, Y1 to Y6 get weaker. They're not off, but they're weaker.
Right.
And also it's known that Y7 affects its own promoter. But this is by genetics. I mean, I don't know if this is true kinetically or not. Okay,
right.
It could be, because when you're in genetics, you're working with a cell that doesn't have Y7. It's different from a cell that does have Y7. So this is evidence by genetics, and we want to see whether we can get at it or not.
It also confirmed by the absolute binding. There must be a binding site.
Yeah, there is binding sites, yeah. But I have to say, in general, what it looks to me is that if you just look at sequence and you have no expression data, you can't make, for instance, if you just look at sequence, it would be difficult to make the hypothesis that there's a hierarchy of binding strings. Only when you have the data plus the expression, then you have enough courage to say, okay, we believe it more, so, because it's just looking at promoter, it's consensus sequences. Okay, but look, but we do have, I think in our data, we do have evidence for this feedback loop, and I'll tell you about that we know already. We're trying to figure out how to detect feedback loops. Okay, so again, I'm saying it's an open problem, it's interesting. Okay, so here's the feedback, and pretty incredible.
There's
a checkpoint. This is the checkpoint, yeah. So here it is. So here's the observation that was made in 1970, more or less. Here you have, and this says seven operons, there's 20 genes. These 20 genes together make up this motor through which fly C, this flagellar subunit, is exported and makes a flagellum. Right? Here's the observation. If you make a mutation in any of these 20 genes, not only in the one that activates these, but any of these 20 genes, all diseases don't get turned on. Any of them. Wait, yeah. Okay, so it's an AND gate somehow, so to speak. An AND gate over 20 genes. You have to have 20 functional genes in order to have these guys turned on. So how? So it was a mystery, and it was solved in 1990. And the mechanism is truly, I love it. It's the following. So Y7 here, it's called Fly A, and it's an alternate sigma factor. It's the one that activates these genes, right? Does anybody have a guess?
What? Mutation, any of one of these 20 turns
the these guys don't get turned on. Even if this transcription factor is made, Fly A is made. It's a mutation that knocks it out. Sure, yeah, it's not a mutation that doesn't do anything to it. Right? A mutation that knocks out its function. Okay, well, I'll tell you that. So the answer is the following. One of these is, this is a protein, is an anti-transcription factor. And like yin and yang, this guy turns on Z, this binds to it and interferes with its binding to RNA polymerase and doesn't let it turn on Zs. So when you make the transcription factor, you also make it, say, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you make it anti. It stops it. It's in a different operon in the same class. Here, flagging. Okay. Okay. Now what happens is that once this thing is motor is fully functional, and functional as an export apparatus, flag M, it gets exported out. Specifically. Therefore, once you finish making this, and it's functional, the concentration of flag M goes down. It's secreted into the cytoplasm, into the extracellular. And flag A becomes liberated and turns on the Zs. And the Zs make one of them, flag C, for example, makes this whole flagellum. So it's a checkpoint on functionality of a functional export apparatus, because you don't want to make this inside the cell if it doesn't can't get out, right? Cell becomes very sick. But it doesn't stop there. Now, the same.
So that's true for all.
Each one of the 20
blocks this. Blocks, yes. And that's the way they were discovered, by the way. It's a mutation that doesn't give you flagella. And
you could block the rotation.
Oh, no. Yeah. So the rotation, for instance. No, but it doesn't. The rotation happens to be in Z. The one thing that's recovered from rotation is, but okay, it doesn't matter. These 20 genes, mutations in them stop this thing from being made. It could be structural or it could be chaperones that help it assemble. Okay, now, but there's an additional. Z6? Oh, no. The negative feedback I'll talk about now, okay? Now look what happens now. So the one is a checkpoint it's a functional checkpoint for finishing this thing, right? Now the flagella grows. This flag M is exported through the flagella, just like the fly C, the subunit is also exported from the flagella. When it grows, this diffusion starts slowing down because of the length. So when the flagella is long enough, the leak of flag M goes down. Its concentration increases in the cell. Increase, and stops fly A. This is what I mean by this negative feedback loop. So the same components also check the length. And the third thing that they do is when you do an experiment and you shear the flagella. If you just calculate diffusion through a one-dimensional. It slows down. It goes like 1/1 length or something. No, it's lattice gathering. Okay, so when it's now if you shear the flagellum, again there's a leak. And phlegm goes down, so its concentration goes down, down, down. And fly A becomes activated, and the flagella repairs itself. See, so you get this feedback loop is really, it's something else, isn't it?
That is the minus loop of that.
That's the minus loop, what I meant by minus loop. That's why it's indirect. Indirect.
It's by making a
heterodyma? Huh?
Is it a heterodyma or, yeah?
No, this means that when the flagella becomes long, 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 indirect, delayed, then fly A.
So both M and A are part of the class 2?
Yeah. And M, by the way, is interesting because M, the promoter of M, is class 2 and also class 3. So M is one component that could be here and also here. And what we see, we just, in fact, this is just a Baroque detail, it doesn't really matter. There's one operon called flag AMN that's made at class 2. This piece of RNA is made in class 2, M is made. And there's another promoter here that's class 3, which makes an RNA that has only M and N on it. So M is made, it's an unusual gene, it's made from two different promoters, and we have both of them. And we can see that this one goes on in class 2, and this one goes on the last, at class 3. And we hypothesize that what its function is to provide, you need another burst of flag M in order to provide the feedback loop for making the flagella really, really long. So that's in the end, in the end, in the end. You make another burst of this protein in order to give the feedback loop. That's a hypothesis again. So again, I have to say again, with genetics, there's another fundamental problem with genetics, and that is if a gene has two roles, two different times in the lifetime of an organism, and you knock it out, you're stuck at the first role. For example, it often happens a lot that you knock out a gene X in a mouse, and the mouse unfortunately dies as an embryo, and you have no clue what X is doing in the adult brain. It's a serious drawback. And there's ways to get around that by making it inducible and only in the adult brain and stuff like that. A knockout only in the adult brain, but it's very difficult. So with this kinetic approach, you can see that flag M goes on in two bursts and maybe make an hypothesis for two functions in two different stages. Okay. So also another comment about complementing genetics. So how do we see this checkpoint in our data? So this checkpoint I think we can see in our data, and this is as follows. We did an experiment under two different conditions. One is when the flagella system is turned on, when the cell has pre-existing flagella made from previous life. And the second is an experiment done when the flagella system is turned on when there are no pre-existing flagella. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. And it turns out that in this situation, you get a nice temporal separation between class 2 and class 3. In this situation, class 2 and class 3 kind of moves up, and some of its overlaps with class 2. Okay? And in fact, the two conditions that I showed on that clustering graph are these conditions. And you can see that class 3 moves up. As a group, its timing shifts forward. So it's a memory effect. It's a memory effect. The cell, the kinetics, you can see in the kinetics, you remember if you made flagella previously. So if you just think about a thought experiment where you turn on flagella synthesis, you make flagella, and then turn it off, and then turn it on again, and there hasn't been enough generation, so the flagella get diluted out, your kinetics are different from a situation where you waited a long time and all the flagella got diluted out. It's a memory effect.
By memory, you mean the remnant of the white
cell. Memory, I mean the following. I mean that if you have a system and you do an experiment with one pulse, and then you wait a time tau, and you do a second pulse. There's a certain range of taus where the kinetics, okay, when tau goes to infinity, you have a certain kinetics. But there's a certain range of taus where the kinetics are different.
That's right, yeah. The reason for that is that...
Okay, the reason. Exactly, okay. The reason is, mechanistically, in this true case, is physical presence of completed basal bodies, this part here. So what happens is that when you have these old from a previous experiment, once flag M is made, it gets out immediately. It doesn't have to wait a long time for production of de novo, the first de novo motor. And therefore, fly A at its low level that it's made is enough to start turning on class 3, and then you have this shifting in time. All the class 3 genes turn on earlier. See what I'm saying? So I ask a question. I don't know if it's true or not. Is this a general kinetic signature of regulatory checkpoints? Right, no, but so when you have mature flagella, you almost always have also partially made flagella. And flagella, they're short, flagella, they're longer. Right, so the mature flagella is... Because you're always making components.
How does the cell disassemble?
It doesn't. So it just gets diluted out by growth. You see, you have a cell with 6 flagella. After one generation, each daughter gets 3. Each daughter gets 1.5. So after enough time, most cells have no flagella. Okay. Typically, in an experiment where you look at a population that's been growing a long time in exponential phase, it doesn't make flagella, you maybe sometimes see one or two cells that, with one flagella moving like a little bit.
So it's like drilling a hole.
It's like drilling a hole, but it's a specific hole. Because there's a checkpoint, there's a gate here, a gate apparatus that recognizes the proteins and like a passport. Right, it only allows flag M and fly C to go out. It's really remarkable. But that's the way it works. This is a fact. I'm not saying that I understand.
Anything. Not all of them have the same name.
Right. Oh, okay. Good point. Yeah. So.
So you can have one which is short enough to let this thing out.
Yeah.
The other one is.
I agree. I think this is another interesting theoretical question here.
This would work.
So you have, at a certain point, you might imagine that you have a flagella that's long, and another flagella that only this part is made, another flagella that only this part is made.
So I think guys are leaking out
through
the short.
They're leaking out through here. Yeah. So somehow it's an integrated decision over the right. The decision is made on the level of concentrations, but you have. I don't know the answer. I mean, but it's a. It's balanced somehow to provide the right proteins for the.
Wait. So is it true that if there's a long one, then the short one will grow until it's long?
I don't know. I don't know this. I mean, people didn't do these quantitative experiments so much, but I find that the system, just like you say, it presents puzzles that are ready for understanding somehow. No, it is, yeah. It goes like 1 over L. Yeah, that's also true. Diffusion length? You mean how long it takes, I don't know if this answers your question, but it takes it 10 milliseconds for protein to cross one side to the other side. Oh no, so the way it's considered to be a well-mixed system because in a tenth of a second you can get from one side to the other. So the fusion of proteins inside the dense cytoplasm is very fast. So that's why people consider it a well-mixed system. Again, I'm sure there are exceptions. Yeah? Oh yeah. No? I think if an engineer thinks about this, it's the American Association of Engineers prize for. No, that's what I say. I mean, this is a. That's why I thought it would be. It's just I love this story. I think it's an example of. I don't know. It just say. But.
What happens if you knock out this flag M?
Ah. Yeah, so when you knock out flag M, what happens is that the way it was discovered was people looked at this phenomenon of 20 genes. You knock out any of these 20 genes and these don't go and turn on. And they looked for genes where you knock them out, it abolishes this AND gate.
Okay.
So if you knock Y1 out, the Z's get turned on. And this was flag M.
So now you
knock 2 out. Yeah. You see, this is a genetics, very powerful logic.
You knock one out, then
you have this. You have an observation that yes, when you knock Y1, Y2, Y3, 4, Z don't get turned on.
One of these Y is flag M itself.
One of these Y is flag M itself, right? So the original experiment people did was knock out operons. So you knock out any of these seven operons, and then also point mutants.
Right?
Yeah. So flag M, yeah, flag M isn't among these 20 because flag M is the one when you knock it out. When you knock flag M out, it alleviates this checkpoint. It alleviates this checkpoint. That's right.
Yeah. So the correct statement is not that any of the 20 yeah. get knocked out.
Right, any of the 20 except for flag M.
Yeah. 19 out of 20.
Yeah, 19 out of 20. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. But that's the way it was discovered. Then it took a while to understand the mechanism. Mechanism was discovered 1990. And it's a beautiful thing.
So again, since you said from your data, I think that's
okay. Well, let's say from our data, we see there's a memory effect. We see this phenomenon
right.
that the kinetics are different.
But you still don't know where I mean, it could happen in many different ways.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm saying that in our data, we see a memory effect between class 2 and class 3. And I'm just saying this because I believe theoretically it's a very interesting problem to this reverse engineering problem is a very interesting problem. Particularly, how do you design the right experiment to get the data to tell you exactly where this feedback loop is? Ah. Well, look. Yeah, that's what we did. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's on the level of the proteins, but you see it in the transcriptional level because the output is transcriptional. But I think we can see things, again, as we do more and more experiments, I'm more and more pleasantly surprised that how much we can see about the protein level. For example, we have another experiment which has to do with DNA repair, where a transcription factor concentration, the transcription factor is degraded, it goes down, 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 and then genes are activated. And just based on the time course, we can kind of calculate the intracellular concentration of this transcription factor, even though it's degraded on a protein level. It's just... How does it exactly block fly A? It's a protein-protein binding, and when it's bound, it doesn't let it interact with... Okay, RNA polymerase. Fly A is what's called an alternate sigma factor. RNA polymerase is made of subunits, they're always constant, plus a sigma that gives it the specificity to the DNA. So this is an alternate to the regular sigma factor, and it gives it specificity to the flagella DNA promoters, the class 3 promoters. And this binds it and doesn't let it interact with RNA polymerase, thereby shutting off its transcriptional activity. You understand? So maybe we should...
overlap you can also explain by...
Take a break. Upstream for X. There is some evidence that X interacts with some of these Zs, but it's only when you don't have Y7. So. But then why does it depend on the presence or absence of different of previous motors? No, I agree. I think it'll be an interesting problem to narrow it down to just one possible feedback. I agree with you. I'm not saying it's the only model. I'm just saying it's an observation. Seeing memory tells you at least the beginning of some feature that's related to this. Okay?